everybody. Welcome to episode 43 of the Alexis Cell podcast. And what a podcast we've got for you. It's a a double episode, well, one episode following another, whatever the technical term for that is. And its official title is A Very Capaldi Christmas, because it's our long interview with Peter Capaldi that we did about his early life and then his later career as Doctor Who and the thick of it and all the other stuff. And I hope you find it a suitable Christmas gift.
We had so much Capaldi, we had to carve it in half, like a turkey. Well, we don't carve turkey, well, whatever. And
we have to curry it and have it on sandwiches.
Yes, exactly. So, we're releasing the first half of our really long chat with Capaldi.
Yeah, and tell all your friends and all your Doctor Who, diehard fan base all around the world. Mm-hmm. And also anybody interested in Star Wars, even though there's nothing about Star Wars in it, but we could trick them into listening.
Yeah, no, he was in Star Wars, wasn't he? He played
a
Goglomite from Planet.
Oh, fucking hell, did he?
Hang on a minute. No, Alexi, we're trying to get Star Wars fans in.
He didn't. I said that was you being funny.
He was Luke Skywalker's uncle's best friend at the milk mine.
Yeah, well, some of that shit. get them listening as well, and boost our figures. Which, Talal, you've got some interesting, exciting information about our.
We've had a million listeners. It's a Christmas miracle.
Yeah,
it's a Christmas miracle. We've had a million. The only one is a man. Yeah, it's going to be a weird. It's going to be weird trying to celebrate Christmas this year, isn't it? Through the dark shadow that covers us all this Christmas season, there is a small beacon of light, and that is that this little endeavor, the Let's Sell podcast, has finally had over a million listens, individual downloads and listens to the podcast. And that does not include people who watch the show on YouTube, which is a considerable amount. They listen to the podcast on YouTube. But through their little podcast devices, mobile phones, laptops, they have had a million listens, which is definitely the biggest thing I've ever been a part of.
I
know in the 90s, your shows used to fart a million viewers.
It's not the biggest thing I've been part of by any means, but still I'll settle for that.
It's insane. And in terms of podcasting, there's a million podcasts out there for people to choose. So we're obviously very grateful for each one of you that chooses to listen to this, man. It's quite surreal, actually.
I think in a way we've maintained. I mean, it's, you learn as you go along. I think we've maintained to a degree. There was obviously an initial burst of enthusiasm and stuff like that. But I think we've maintained we've kept the energy up, haven't we, really?
The quality is always on an upward tick, and we mix it up too. I don't think we've ever rested on laurels. Well, maybe in terms of formatting and kind of the way the dynamic kind of goes. But like in terms of the guests we have on and the topics we discuss, we do kind of spread the gamut, don't we?
Yeah.
What do you think? Little quiz time, a Christmas quiz for Alexa.
Yeah.
Do you want to try and guess which episodes are in our top five listen to episodes?
Yeah. I think the thing that our listeners want most is the driest, dullest podcasts about internal left-wing politics. So I would say Phil Bevin I can't remember after people now, really. Corbyn R for Road Java with Con Ross, the Evelyn Waugh one. I didn't really like those women much. And
One at a time. What? Go on. Name one. Because so name far. One.
Well, I'm deliberately. I know that
you're running a list of what, only the Jeremy Corbyn out of the ones you've all said. Yeah. Out of all the ones you've said, only the Jeremy Corbyn one is in the top five.
Yeah.
So that one's in the top five. Any other guesses?
Well, no. I mean, if I'm honest, I think I know that the ones that people, the ones that get the most listeners are actually the ones with other comedians and stuff, aren't they? Although, actually, Bassam Youssef, who's like mega, maybe we should repackage that one because he's, especially at the moment.
Especially at the moment, we could repost that one.
But I know that the Stuart Lee one was the most.
Stuart Lee, number one with a bullet.
Yeah.
For sure. Jeremy Corbyn is in there.
Oh, of course, I forgot we interviewed him.
You mentioned that. That's the number four.
Yeah.
And then our first episode.
Right.
Keir Starmer, Establishment Tool. The very first episode we dropped, that's in there too. That's number two.
Right.
And then the second episode is also in there. And then surprisingly, sneaking its way into the top five, is the episode we did with David Rennick and Andrew Marshall.
Really?
Yeah, Comedy Too Many Ronnies.
That was quite an early one as well, wasn't it, Bob?
It was quite early. And a few of the early ones snuck into the top five. But then after that, it's all kind of later ones. You've got Diane Morgan, very popular.
Of course, another comedian,
Ahmed Jalili, very popular.
Right.
And then some nice solo ones where it's just you and me. That's finishing stupid. Out the top 10. Oh, Josie Long, very popular one, actually.
Right.
Young One Special. I'm going past the top 10 now. But the Young Ones one, we need to do that again. We need to do another Young Ones.
Yeah.
We need to get Bloody Nigel in, man.
Bloody Nigel, I'll have to see him all the bloody time. So
I love him so much.
Do you?
And the afternoon we spent with him and Lisa watching the Young Ones in Lisa's house. Patreons get an exclusive look at the first episode of that. I've yet to put together the second one, but there is another episode in the tank. So, you know, join the Patreon. And look, while I'm on the topic of listeners and that, we love that we have so many supporters on the Patreon. Look, let me just read a couple messages from our Patreon community who we love and adore, right, Lex?
Yes, we do.
When we first created the Patreon about a year ago, maybe a bit more than a year ago, we promised them nothing, right? That was like the whole the whole gimmick of that was kind of like a Stalinist thing where you like, there was different tiers. There was like a gold membership, silver membership, platinum membership. But the big promise, you wrote a nice little, a nice cover letter for me to post and it's still up there. Promising our patrons nothing in return for their support and their money. But that's not true anymore. There is exclusive content that only patron listeners get. Patron subscribers.
Betrayed the purity of the revolution, but still that always happens.
And there will be more to come. You've got me and Alexi shooting guns. My brother edited that video with his hip-hop music, and it's really good. If you like guns, it's kind of like... The subject matter isn't very complex, but it's literally just us at a shooting range talking about the guns.
I wish we'd been... We were so intent on not embarrassing the people at the rifle range that...
Yeah, and we still had
us
to...
a bit.
Well, so and also we did have a word, you know, people had a word with us, like, you better watch what you talk about. So we were kind of had our hands tied. We couldn't wax lyrical about the political complexity of the whole situation.
No.
We just got to shoot some guns and say, ooh, you burnt your finger a little bit on one of the guns. That's quite exciting. we got the Young Ones watch-alongs on there, and there'll be more of that to come. And I'll be putting, like, video... So this Capaldi episode, we filmed the whole thing. So I'll put video clips or maybe the whole thing... up on the Patreon so that you can look at his face while he talks to us.
Okay.
Let me just read a quick couple messages. So Simon on the Patreon, we love you, Simon. He's been a member since December 2022. He says, sorry, it's a bit late. I wanted to suggest during the next podcast, it might be a good idea to mention the number of patrons while appealing for additional new ones.
Okay. Yeah.
So we have 298 patrons.
Right. What's the difference? We got 15,000 subscribers. What's the difference? Or is that just, what's the difference?
Those are just people who listen to the podcast for free.
And, oh, right.
And that's absolutely great. We're not bitter about anyone who's not a patron member.
I'm bit.
But you know, you get all this lovely stuff from us for free, and we never gonna put adverts in the show. And if you can afford to like buy us a cup of coffee a month or buy me a beer a month, or you know,
yes,
and it's not too much off your back, then please consider going to patreon.com/AlexisSalePodcast.
Please.
And help keep the show running, man.
Please.
My time costs money. Equipment costs money. Microphones.
Mm-hmm.
When we're going on the road tomorrow to record another episode with someone. And I'm going to need to pay for congestion charge, parking. Yeah. You know, this stuff, time and stuff costs money to make a podcast. The subscription fees for Audio Boom, Zencaster, all this shit. So you're... contribution really, really helps. So we have 298 patrons.
All right.
Let's get them. That up to 350 in the new year.
Let's do that.
Come on, guys. Simon finishes, keep up the interesting shows and thank you for the nothing. I really appreciate it. J. Coprario on Patreon says, thank you for the excellent shows. Would you consider interviewing Craig Murray? Do you know who Craig Murray is?
Yes, that's a good idea. I really like Craig Murray. I read his blog for nothing. And he's a really, really interesting guy. I think he always really incisive analysis of contemporary.
Yes. And on his.
And that's a very good idea.
Recently, very recently, on a return from a work trip to Iceland, he got detained by Scottish police.
Well, he was actually, I mean, it's like...
Of Assange and Palestine.
He spent time in prison, like 3 months or something, for this thing called jigsaw identification, which nobody has ever, apart from him, ever been charged with. And it's partly about how poisonous, I think, politics up there in Scotland is now. Certainly from the nationalists, and I suspect the Labour Party as well.
Okay. We'll make a mental note. But maybe we reach out to him.
Yeah. That's a very good idea.
Sean on Patreon, Stylophobia on Patreon, Emily on Patreon. Thank you so much for your support and your lovely messages too. I will stop harping on about it. One more though, on our Instagram, you can follow us on Instagram at AlexisSalePod. Amy messaged. Yeah, this is the last thing I want to talk about or mention is she says, just traveled from London to Reading to see Alexi live. You're not ready for retirement yet. That was amazing. She absolutely loved it. She said you smashed it. Mm-hmm. So what, you hosted a comedy night in Reading recently?
Yeah, it was, it was a weird one really. It was the Slapstick Festival, which is a festival in Bristol, but they hold a fundraising comedy benefit every year, but because the venues are so expensive in Bristol, they actually held it in Reading. And originally, Omid was scheduled to MC it, but I think he's had a bit of trouble with... he's had to cancel some dates and stuff, and all the posters featuring Omid in the, I think, around the city had their eyes torn out and stuff like that.
Wow.
Yeah, and so they offered it to me.
How is he more controversial than you?
Well, I said to, you know, I mentioned this to the audience at the start that his eyes had been torn out, and I said I was sorry I'd done that, but...
All right, I see.
It's a desperate attempt to get back into the Reading Hexagon, which I haven't been since 1995. I don't know, it's weird. I don't know what it is. I mean, I don't want to get... I don't know whether it is. I know he's very opposed to the government in Iran, which is perfectly reasonable. They are pretty terrible. So it may be that, or
he's quite
maybe
politically
just
active. He's also not white, which is also But yeah, did you have fun doing that?
I did. I really enjoyed it. It was a bit. I thought I sort of got out there, and I thought, "Fucking hell! I've only done 3 gigs this year." Mm-hmm. I'm not, you know, if you perform every night, you get so much more match fit so that, you know, any interruption, anything happens. And I wasn't in that state, but I did a fair amount of new material. And, you know, being MC is a thing I'm useful, not in the, in the modern, you know, I don't do crowd work and all that bullshit, but, you know, yeah, I kept things going, I think, between. Yeah, it was, I really enjoyed it, especially towards the end, I think. I think I got warmed up, the audience got warmed up, and then.
Would you be up for in the next year to do a couple?
I don't know, it's difficult.
Live podcasts.
Oh, live podcasts. With me. Yes, that's a good idea, yeah.
They're a lot easier than doing stand-up.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Just need a good guest, a bit of Q&A.
Yeah.
Can we make that a New Year's resolution?
Let's
do some live shows.
Yeah.
Maybe I could plan us a little mini tour or something.
All right, if you want. Okay. Yeah, why not? Yeah. Be easier than, so I can't really, you know, I did sort of had a tour of big venues penciled in, and I just cancelled it really because I didn't feel, I didn't really feel up to. The material was all working and stuff, really. I just, I don't know. I just, it's, I didn't feel in the mood for it, really. So, but I have to, yeah. I mean, I do feel an obligation in a sense to perform. I think if you have a talent like mine, you should exercise it.
Yes. But look, you've done your years. I mean, you've given so much.
I've been in show business. Yeah, I have.
Bastards. You've done so much. You've set so much groundwork for other comedians.
Yeah.
It's not like you owe anyone anything.
No, I suppose not. But if you can do it, you should kind of keep doing it. But I've been in show business for 45 years. It's ridiculous.
He's 70 now.
71.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Linda told me to stop doing that voice. She hates it.
Oh, did she?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay.
Which I agree.
Sorry for prompting you then.
That's all right. I think.
Well, it's Christmas. It's Christmas, isn't it?
It's Christmas. I don't crack this just for a few minutes. So I've got to me dog died.
Do you hear that?
What?
Some little jingling of bells. I think it's the Crimbus Capaldi sleigh on the rooftop. Do you hear that, Alexi?
I do. I hear it now. Now you mention it, yeah.
I think the
You're saying we should get the fuck on with this.
Christmas Capaldi's coming down the chimney.
All right, I think he is. He's in the living room. He's got a knife.
No. Put it down. No, we'll listen, I swear. Let's throw to it, man. Come on, we've all teased right. It we've left the listeners dangling.
All right, Merry
Christmas. What are we going to?
Yeah, Merry Christmas, Capaldi. Here we go, episode 1, Dream Boys. In a desperate attempt to address our falling listening figures.
What?
This is really our last chance, I think, to make the big time. I've managed to persuade Peter Capaldi to come on my podcast. And apparently this is the first podcast you've ever done.
First one ever that I remember. Maybe somebody out there is going to go, oh, he did ours. So
yeah.
That's a whole pile of them, but I don't remember.
Well, that's
technology moves so quickly and changes, so it doesn't seem much different from being on the radio, really.
Except it's in my ass.
Yeah,
it's the same. Well, I also thought that I would largely make this about me, really, rather than...
Sure.
So we could talk about when we first met and what you think of me and
the part... This is normal. This is the way it goes.
The part I've played in your career. And, yeah. Well, we'll start there and then go back, really. When we reminisce about when we met.
Well, when we met was different from when I first saw you. Because we met when we were in the ITV show Selling Hitler. And you were playing the man who had...
The forger, Connie Kuya.
Who had forged Hitler's diaries and mm-hmm. sold them to Stern. And I was playing some journalist or other in that. That's when we met. But I'd seen you before. I'd been in the audience at the Raymond Review Bar.
Oh, right, okay.
To see you in the comic strip perform, which I thought was amazing. I'd never seen anything like that, really. I didn't know what this was. You know, it was at that time, which I guess would have been...
1980.
The idea that people could get up on stage in a little black painted room with a microphone and conjure up this whole world of comedy, that wasn't, you know, mother-in-law jokes and frilly shots and all that, was brand new. So, and of course you were a sort of dazzling star in that firmament, yeah. And among, you know, and you were the host of the evening and held it together with a kind of belligerence and sort of brilliance and were amazing. And it was, you know, and Rick Mayall was there, who was astounding, you know, and it was just all this fantastic stuff. I thought, this is a bit like seeing, I don't know, Elvis or something, you know, it's like, yeah. He agrees.
Yeah, he agrees.
This was at the comedy store, the old comedy store.
No, comic strip.
The comic strip, yeah.
And that was a separate venue.
That was later. That was a year later, yeah.
Yeah. So that was where I first saw you.
And then, in fact, we sort of met because your wife, Elaine, played my girlfriend.
That's right.
And so I don't know, because I don't think we had any scenes together, but I had scenes with Elaine.
You had scenes with Elaine.
And she told me how much.
And you seemed to get on quite well.
Yeah. Because I famously told her she wasn't famous enough to come to the rap party. She could come as, yeah, she still goes on about it. I said she could come as your guest.
Right.
But she couldn't, her part was too insignificant for her to come.
Well, that was a little cruel.
I think it set the template for, and I was only joking.
Were you?
Yes. I was only mostly joking.
Mostly joking.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we met through Elaine.
And we've been friends
together since.
You've been together since, yeah. It's true. So, well, I mean, so having talked about me, go back. Having satiated that desire. I mean,
that's it, by the way.
Yeah.
So when was that part, when you were in the show together? When was that?
1990 it was.
Pre your sketch show.
No, it was after two series of my sketch.
Oh, yeah, and we did your sketch show as well. You very kindly invited me to be there, which was great fun, which I loved. Because that whole... But that whole sort of, let's call it alternative comedy thing, was a very radical and exciting world. And I was desperate to be part of it, but only ever managed to puncture it through you. For your benevolence.
Well, that's with this. You're in that. You're in the Sherlock Holmes sketch, and you is that with also with double Oscar award winner Christoph Waltz? Is he in that sketch, or is he in it?
I don't think
one?
He's in that.
He's in it. It's the one where you're trying to get more money out of me.
That's right.
Am I Watson and you're Holmes, or you're Holmes?
I'm Holmes and you're Watson.
Right.
And I can remember the keenly that the when I went to play. The comedy Sherlock Holmes in this sketch, the makeup lady said, I've got a tub of nose wax here, she said, so that I can give you a big nose if you so require. And then she looked at my nose and went, no, you're fine.
That's also, we tried to employ, both me and the crew are socially maladroit. I always try and use
Yeah, I remember she was smoking as well at the time.
Really? So, to go back, I was vaguely thinking about questions I would ask you, that you come from, a community of Italian migrants to Scotland.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, my grandfather was Italian.
Yeah.
He married a Scottish woman. He came from a little village called Piccinisco in Italy, which is in Martin, south of Rome. I think he went to America, first of all. But as ever, these kind of family tales are veiled in mystery. And especially in those days, I think you could disappear by just, you know, moving to Carlisle or something.
Right.
And you could say you'd gone to America. But his, I guess, his cousins and brothers were what we call economic migrants. They were looking for to earn a living, because much as, I mean, having been to Piccinisco, which is gorgeous in Italy, there isn't really much there in terms of work or a future, or there wasn't at that time. And he was a shepherd, and he actually didn't even live in the village. I think it was a case of there was a better life elsewhere, and so I think there was a trail blazed by various cousins and brothers who set up cafes, and you know, it was a kind of traditional business. I mean, Scottish Italians are all in either fish and chips or ice cream or hairdressing. You don't want to get them mixed up. Because you don't want hair in your ice cream, obviously, or hair in your chips. So I think Pilonettini is, from a fish and chip family.
Right.
I think Tom Conti, I think, is from a hairdressing family.
Right.
And I'm from celebrated ice cream family.
Yeah. Capaldi's ice cream. And Armando Iannucci lived around the corner, the producer.
Amanda, well, I didn't really know. The funny thing was, for the first 8 years of my life, I lived in a tenement in Glasgow, in a very kind of, in that kind of classic kind of old tenement kind of style lifestyle, which I loved, which was absolutely, I mean, my granny, my father's mother lived downstairs, and my mother's mother lived across the road, and all my uncles lived within walking distance, so all my cousins.
And was it like a Little Italy, or was it?
No, it wasn't a Little Italy at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. I mean, that's a kind of, you know, nobody spoke Italian. They weren't really, everybody was just Scottish.
So you didn't have a sense of being part of a community, of being part of a kind of either a Catholic or...
Oh, Italian. Catholic, yeah, very, very much Catholic, yeah.
Yeah.
Because my mother was really of Irish heritage.
Right.
So we were doomed to Catholicism, whatever we did. We weren't kind of... I guess that's the beginning of my, you know... long-standing inauthenticity in the world, because people would always meet you and think you came from a family with an accordion playing father and a cafe and made spaghetti all the time and all that, but we didn't. But it was a little bit mysterious, because my grandfather died when I was 18, so I never met him. But there were these kind of haunting pictures of him, and he had this kind of quite dark kind of look about him. And my grandmother, who was very Scottish, I know had been in Italy for quite a while, but I could never piece all these bits together. How had she been in Italy, and what had gone on in Italy? And of course, you know, you start... The sad thing is you get older and people, you know, leave us, and you don't have anybody to question about this stuff anymore.
No.
But it was a great... Upmate.
Just say a word from our sponsors, Ancestry.com. You could.
Did you feel any urge to make their migration worth it or anything? Or like,
These weren't issues that were raised at all. People just got, were just getting on with whatever. You know, my grandfather and his sons all worked every hour God sent, you know, in shops or cafes or. Yeah. You know, making ice cream. What I loved was they used to say that there was a special recipe for our ice cream that had been brought from Italy and was kept under lock and key somewhere. But in fact,
walls.
Well, it was large plastic bags of powder that came from Slough. Well, they'd mixed up in a vat.
Where did they sell it? Did you have a cafe or a van or what?
We had, I think my grandfather originally had one of those, you know, Groucho, not what's the Marx brother who Chico,
right.
Chico's often seen with an ice cream barrel.
Right.
My grandfather, Giovanni, had a barrel.
Right.
Which he sold ice cream from. And then eventually they had a cafe in beneath the same tenement that we lived in. And then we had an ice cream, I use this word advisedly, factory.
Right.
It was a kind of cobblestone petrol smell.
A workshop.
Workshop. Yeah.
But the ice cream would only be retailed through the Capaldi Cafe.
It was the part. No, no, we had vans.
Oh, you had vans?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So we had Capaldi's ice cream vans.
All right.
Eventually.
So you moved. So was that when the fleet of vans came? I assume that you moved into.
We moved into to Bishop Briggs, which was a sort of suburban kind of wimpy house kind of enclave.
Right.
Full of taxi drivers and stuff like that.
Was that like a big wrench? I don't know.
I think for my, you know, I think for my parents, they were, that was the right move to make because they wanted to get away from, this was in the days before, you know, the tenements were crumbling. Some years later, a decade later, they were being rebuilt and sandblasted and turned into nice homes for people and stuff like that. Yeah. But they were sort of crumbling and a bit too busy. And so I think to move into a nice house was kind of everybody's ambition. And they did that.
And then you progressed through school and you went to the... You then went to the famous Glasgow Art School.
I did. I went to art school, but that was only because I didn't get into drama school.
Really?
I was rejected by drama school. Soundly.
Fucking idiot. Shows you.
Well, maybe not. I don't know. Maybe the gods were smiling.
Yeah, I was rejected from film school.
Were you?
Yeah.
That's a terrible...
And I ended up teaching at one of the ones, film schools that had rejected me.
And what did you teach?
I was teaching...
Bitterness.
Repercussions.
Repercussions.
Yeah. I was teaching. It was London School of Printing.
Okay.
They had a film school which they rejected me from, and then I was the next year I was there as a teacher. I was teaching printing apprentices, general studies. So it wasn't like. But I think for a while they got a bit worried because they thought that I'd refused their rejection and just turned up. I refused not to go. So I remember the first time encountering.
Yeah.
One of the lecturers who turned me down, him looking a bit worried. Anyway, that's not the end of it.
Well, of course, I later met the people who had rejected me. I think they were quite right to reject me. I didn't think that.
Yeah.
But I think they were quite... I think I was hopeless.
Yeah. I think that all the... I applied to Royal College Film School. After I left Chelsea, that film school in Beaconsfield, the National.
Yeah.
And then later, London College of Printing Film School. I think they were all right. To reject me, really, because I wasn't ready, you know.
Yeah. How about now? Are you ready now?
I think I would just go straight to... Well, I often say... I mean, sometimes, like, I'm like a collect honorary professorships.
I've got four.
Yeah, it's a hobby of mine.
Okay.
I've got four. And then I say to the people, like, I'm a fellow of the... what's they called? The St. Martin's, Central St. Martin's in Chelsea and... I forget what it's called, University of the Arts. And I always say, oh, yeah, you know, I'd love to come and teach. You know, I'm a trained teacher because I've trained to be a lecturer. And they say, yeah, you know, we'd love to come and teach. And then nobody ever gets in touch with me.
Mm.
So had you been accepted by film school?
Yeah.
What oeuvre would you have pursued?
I think I was so, I mean, it would have been, if I had been accepted at film school, I would have, after the first term in the Christmas term, I would have had to go in front of the board and I would have been asked to leave, really.
why would
because
that
I was so chaotic and I, you know.
But you must have had some imaginary vision of yourself as.
I don't think I did. I think I just
David Lean, who no, famously, who you famously
put to sleep. Yeah, I haven't told that story. Yeah,
well, I think you should. Although we've given away the end of it now.
Yeah. Maybe another. We'll save it for another time. Yeah.
But you must have, if you thought, you can't go to film school, was it just something to do?
I think I felt it was, it should have been the next step. And instead, I did odd jobs for the next 5 years, really. But I think that was, I am eternally grateful for that rejection, really.
So how did you get from being rejected from film school to being a stand-up comedian?
Well, this isn't about me, Peter, but seeing as we haven't discussed this. You see, that's one of the things, isn't it? We've known each other, see each other most weeks, but never. So I left Chelsea in summer of 74, and then applied to film. I had a year off, worked in the civil service, and I applied to film school in 75 whenever I was rejected. So then 76, 77, 78, 79, I just did odd jobs, filing, and did a bit of part-time lecturing and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. 79, the comedy store opened because I was in a friend of mine asked me to be in a Brechtian cabaret troupe, and I started doing stand-up within the troupe, really.
Okay.
And then when I auditioned for the comedy store and they offered me the job of MC, mm-hmm. and then that year later that led to the comic strip that we talked about before. But I think that I built, in those 5 years of unemployment, I built up a tremendous well of kind of resentment and anger. And it was a really terrific experience, I think, to not be heard. You know, I've never talked about this before, actually, but I mean, I think it's to seethe with resentment that nobody's like treat, because I was like doing really, I mean, cleaning toilets, washing dishes, shit like that. To be unheard was a tremendous motivator, I think, really, you know.
But how do you know, you say that, but you also said you auditioned for the comic strip. Now, it takes a lot to audition. You know, it's like the stories when people say, how did you become an actor? Oh, I went and my mate was auditioning and I was there as well. And then they said to me, really? Is that really what happened? You went with your mate to, you know, and they just said, you have a go. So what I'm saying is, it takes a certain set of mind to audition. So what was that?
Well, because I'd already been doing this show with this other actor, Bill.
Right.
And we'd been touring it around like student unions. And in that show, it was a sketch show, but I would step out and do what turned out to be stand-up. So I had, I had a large body of material ready to go. And that's what I did for my audition at the comedy store. Yeah. So I had like...
And was it an ad in the newspaper or something?
In Private Eye, yeah.
The Private Eye.
Yeah, yeah. But no, I'd had tons of experience. I'd had loads of experience of really difficult, hostile audiences and, you know, knowing that this material was really, that nobody else was doing it and stuff. So no, I wasn't an ingenue. And I was really experienced by the time they asked me to be MC of the comedy store.
But what was the fuel then? Was it this rage? Was it this resentment? Yeah. Because you don't get up in front of an audience with just yourself and a microphone without some degree of courage and some fuel that makes you meet that challenge.
Have you ever thought of having a podcast? So there's the rage and resentment. There's a tremendous desire to be heard. But also there's the knowledge that I knew I was fucking brilliant. I knew I was really good. Not necessarily. You see me, I'm not necessarily. I mean, I'm a lot better than I used to be. But I'm not one of them, you know, in a social situation, I can be awful. I can cast a terrible pall. But, you know, on a stage, I knew that I could really... I knew from the first moment I started doing it that I was fucking better than anybody else.
What you said isn't universal. You go to open mics now, you see a lot of just blind entitlement and, like, people who might believe that they're the bollocks, but then they've not got anything... No fire in them, nothing to really say that's unique. So I'm sitting there going, okay, so... Some people have been told their whole life they're great. It sounds like you needed to be, or you told yourself that.
Yeah, I needed that affirmation. But back to you, what propelled you then, Peter?
Yeah.
Capaldi. I mean, were your parents happy that you went to art school for starters?
They were happy because they thought I could be a teacher.
Right, because you are a fantastic artist as well.
Well, that's very sweet of you to say. I think I was very lucky that I was born at a certain time. I was born in 1958, and so therefore higher education was seen as a right and was paid for by the government, and also was seen as a thing that you pushed your kids to do.
Yeah.
I mean, my parents were in essence very ordinary people, but every one of their kids went to university or art college. They didn't have the money to pay for that.
No.
And it wasn't a loan, you know, but it was still part of that post-war rebuilding of the country
It's all professional. That shows you the unprofessional of podcasting.
Welcome to the Alexis Hale podcast.
Text. I wonder who it's from.
Oh, God. Did you do all like the school plays and shit at school?
No, we didn't have school plays. We did eventually have one. Our school was fairly limited in its resources and in its. It's another world.
Were you always a performer growing up? Like a show off or doing skits for the family?
Yeah, I think
and stuff.
I've tried to think about this and see. I think I liked to perform, but when I was a little kid, I had a little shoebox, which I cut the front off of, and a shoebox is a thing that shoots gummy.
Yes. Yes. I don't know what you thought.
It's a cardboard.
We still have
oblong,
those now.
It's an oblong cardboard.
Was it one per shoe or?
You could put two shoes.
Whoa! Two shoes!
But I cut the front off of it and with a little biro pen, I drew a studio. Because at the time there was a show called Ready, Steady, Go, which was like sort of pre-Top of the Pops, which is where pop groups appeared. And then I drew a little Beatles and made little Beatles. And I made, because also on Ready, Steady, Go, it set that thing of being able to see the cameras. You'd see the cameras, the pop group would be playing and the Beatles would be playing or the Stones would be playing and the cameras would be ranging around as well. And I used to play with these. I made this all myself. And I think I was just looking for some expression of this creativity that I had. But there was no history of it. My uncle Peter, who I was named after, was actually had been in the war and been in ENSA with Frankie Howard, and had been a singer, had been a crooner before giving up to become an ice cream man, and he also painted, and he would encourage me to draw and paint. And my mysterious grandmother, who apparently had been to Italy mysteriously, kept going on about how it was Italian to draw and paint and Da Vinci and Michelangelo and all this, but it all be Italian. She herself was from Ayrshire. So I think there was just this well of creativity, which was also performing.
Yeah,
but I wasn't particularly a show-off or a class clown or anything like that. I just wanted to do something. I didn't want to stand at a bus stop. I have a very, you know, powerful, you know, sense of remembering. I didn't want to stand in a bus stop in the rain going to the same job every day. I wanted to break out of that. And that was a common story. And a lot of people were doing that, you know. So I was looking for a way. And it might have been music, or it might have been, acting, or it might have been art. It was just a way to deploy whatever gifts I had.
And so you applied and got into the GSA?
I applied to drama school and went to Central.
Oh, London.
And to RADA, But of course, it was hopeless from the start because nobody had never seen a Shakespeare play. I'd hardly been to a play at all. I'd only ever seen pantomimes in Glasgow. I wasn't interested really in being a Chekhovian actor. Mm. I was just interested in having a bit of a spotlight and being on the telly maybe, yeah. So when I asked to do a modern piece, I had no idea even what what a modern play was. And so I had to go and look all that up. And Shakespeare, well, that was hopeless. I just did some terrible, found some Shakespeare thing and did it. And it was awful. So they were quite right to say, forget it. There are other kids here who are serious about this. But you see, I think creativity comes in all shapes and forms. And that, I was an actor and I am an actor. And it's what I've done mm-hmm. most of my life. And I think I was terrible then. And then I was a little bit less terrible. And I got a little bit, the more I did, still occasionally absolutely terrible. And then it was shocking and then got a bit better. And then just by practice, one began to get a bit better. So I wasn't wrong to pursue that ambition. Sorry, I've forgotten the question.
No, it was supposed to be.
Did I go to art school?
Yeah. And what did you think was going to happen there, and who did you
I was rejected by drama school, which broke my heart, but I was slightly relieved.
It's a weird mix. Did you come down to,
I came down to London, which was a mysterious, strange kind of place.
And where did you stay and stuff?
I don't think I stayed over. I think I might have just come down and
got the train
overnight. I can remember standing on Swiss Cottage tube station platform after the audition, and gradually all the other people who were rejected came onto the platform, and we sort of nodded uncomfortably to each other. Then I went
off. That was
from
Central.
That was Central from our separate ways. So I didn't really have a plan about what where I would go, but my art teacher at school, Mr. Boyle, who was lovely, who'd always been a kind of champion of my drawing, said, well, you should go to art school. And I looked into it and found that I'd missed the date for the delivery of the folio. And he said, well, I'll phone them up and say, they should have a look. So he phoned them up and they looked at, I threw together a folio and I got in. So I don't know, but it was the best thing. It was the right thing to do. It worked out well because I loved art school. And as you know, that's just a whole different ethos there. I mean, the irony was that actually before Trainspotting, actors were quite uncool. Kids didn't want to be actors,
right.
Particularly, Scottish kids. So there wasn't a kind of... when I was at art school and we'd see people from the drama school, they wore like cardigans and stuff like that, and they weren't cool, and they didn't, they didn't have a kind of edge to them. And they spoke in that kind of odd sort of way. So I very quickly abandoned any ambition in that and recognised that this kind of cauldron of creativity was much more me and was certainly cooler.
We always had the impression that in Scottish art schools they still taught you stuff.
Yeah.
Which they didn't, which Chelsea had completely abandoned that kind of pedagogic notion, really. So you had life drawing and...
We did have life drawing. I think it was already beginning to be seen as a bit pointless. There was a wave of teachers that we had who were obsessed with conceptualism. I'm saying all this now, I didn't know this at the time. I wasn't going, we're not getting that conceptualist English guy again teaching us. Right. We're just going, that's that twat's coming and he's drawing on about all of that stuff. But now I recognise what was happening was cultivated and driven into a conceptualist kind of corner.
You mean performance art or kind of like
I mean in terms of painting and drawing.
Right.
And of course I was hopeless because I had a sort of gift, which of course I squandered by, going for curries and spending my grand on lager and stuff like that. And And you'd, I remember vividly, you know, what happens, as you know, is you're the best in your class at drawing, and then you go to art school and everybody's the best in their class.
Yeah, oh God, yeah.
So you very quickly recognize that some of them are not that good. And you go, oh, well, they're not that good. I'm better than them. And so you go for a drink and then you come back in 3 months and they're fabulous because they worked.
Wow.
And they took their what talent they had and they worked and applied and blossomed. So I was slow to recognize.
Took it for granted.
I took it for granted, and I was slow to recognize that labor was the way to discipline. I don't mean that in a heavy kind of way.
Yeah.
You know, that you had, you know, Picasso spent, anybody who's a great artist gets up in the morning and does artwork.
All day, yeah.
All day long.
Yeah, yeah.
Every day.
Yeah.
You know, Van Gogh doesn't go, you know, he's up every single day doing that stuff.
Yeah.
You know.
So was it 3 years or 4 years?
4 years.
4 years at GSA. And so in that time, well, you lived in a flat?
I moved into a flat, yeah, which is what we did. The Scottish art schools are different from English art schools. We did a foundation year in the same college, whereas I think in England you could go and do a foundation year elsewhere. Mm-hmm. We did a foundation year in the art school, and then I specialised in drawing and painting. But then I was so badly behaved that they threatened to throw me out.
Oh, me too.
Yeah. So I thought I better get my shit together because I like it here, and I was moved then to. Graphics, which I couldn't do, but I could draw.
Yeah.
So I used to do illustration. So I got a degree in illustration.
Oh, okay.
And that's where Muriel Gray was there also.
Was she a student there?
She was a student there as well.
Was she? What was she like?
She very came. Glamorous.
Really?
Very, very, very exciting and very sharp and very creative. Very artful.
Well, she'd get her on, I suppose.
I think you should. I think she was really good. And of course, she got, while we were there, she got to present the tube, which was.
That's why she was still there.
Well, maybe it was after.
I met her in like 84.
Right.
I think when we did the tube.
But of course, that was shocking to all of us that she could go off and become famous when we were all intending to be famous.
She got in there. So how did you progress from being an artist to being a performer then?
When I was at art school, I went to art school in 1976.
Okay.
Which was when punk exploded. So we all arrived, was it 75? We certainly arrived all looking like Neil Young, you know, with long hair and, you know, army reject jackets and stuff like that. And then when we came back the next term, punk had happened. So we all had peroxide hair and leather trousers and stuff like that. And everybody wanted to be in a band. So I wanted to, so that was obviously a very clear way to perform and to be creative. So I started a band. So, and that became a kind of obsession.
What were they called?
And they had the worst name of any band ever. They were called the Dream Boys, which was this was before, lovely, obviously, the advent of these male stripper groups. And we thought it was that we were hoping it would be a Kafka-esque kind of nightmare-esque.
Yeah, like living in a dream.
Dr. Caligari-esque,
yeah,
kind of thing. But it wasn't. It just became this terrible name, which has haunted me ever since. Right. But it was great fun to do, you know, because everybody did it.
Where did you... I mean, Ferguson was one of your...
Craig was the drummer. And we played in it, the art school. We played all over Glasgow. We did lots and lots of gigs.
And you were bass?
You know, I sung and played guitar and, you know, all that.
Wrote your own songs or...?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
How'd that go down?
They were terrible. They were absolutely... I mean, they were terrible songs and... I didn't know any. You just got up and you did them. I'm amazed now when I think about it.
Do you remember what you sang about? What were the topics? And
oh yeah,
do you remember anything?
Of course I do. Yeah, a weird song called "Outer Limits," which was a kind of pastiche of the. There was a TV show called Outer Limits, which was a kind of sci-fi fantasy thing. So that was a song about someone who has found himself trapped in a TV show.
What kind of musical genre would you play? Because this was what was musically we influences.
Well, we had our own genre.
Yeah,
it was called. We had our own genre. It was called Bizarro Punk.
Okay,
because we loved people like the Cramps and stuff. Right. Like that. We went to see the Cramps, who were amazing, and they always had a kind of slightly retro kind of B movie kind of quality about them. So we kind of pursued that, but also we also thought we were a bit like Talking Heads and all that kind of stuff. But we weren't really. We didn't sort of work hard enough to. We just enjoyed the. The fun of it, but we kind of did it. You know, it was a full time thing. It
really?
Was, yeah, and it
you made money.
No.
What sense was it
full time? It was a full time. We made money. We never got signed up or anything. I mean, I used to always have to come to London with cassettes and go around record companies and try.
Wow.
And just after a few years, you just go, oh, I can't do this anymore. No one would sign. You know, it seemed everybody was getting signed up, and we weren't getting signed up, and it got harder and harder and harder.
Did you have like a small group of fans who followed you everywhere?
Yeah.
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 Everybody, no matter how shit. I mean, that's what Flight of the Conchords partly revealed, wasn't it? Everybody, I'm not saying you were shit, but everybody, no matter how shit, has a little group of fans.
Yeah. Well, what's funny is you don't realise, you know, the gods of rock and roll, you know, play games and tricks, you know, on you. So, you know, for instance, Craig, when he joined the band, Craig came from Cumbernauld, which was a satellite town of Glasgow. He thought that joining a Glasgow band was a big deal.
So relative.
That simply by joining a Glasgow band, he was taking two or three steps towards Top of the Pops or something like that. Which, of course, he was just joining another floundering Glaswegian band. But then, of course, we would be desperate to support. You get a good support gig of some of that, but then there would be bands who would support us, and I was going, they were even farther down the food chain than us, which was unbelievable. And I remember, and this is where the gods of rock and roll play tricks on you. I did. We got a gig in Grangemouth, which is a kind of, you know, it's
refinery
like
town.
It's like the start of Blade Runner,
yeah.
The original Blade Runner.
Yeah.
It's like that, you know, with all the kind of flames going off and stuff like that, on a smaller Scottish scale.
Yeah.
And there was a hotel down there where they were doing. I mean, the thing about at that time, which you've got to understand, is Glasgow District Council had banned punks from playing. So there was a period when you couldn't. There weren't any gigs in Glasgow itself. Because they were so horrified by the idea of this this radical kind of violent movement taking over and terrorizing the population, so there were a lot of gigs sprang up all over the place, but there was one in Grangemouth, which was a hotel. I can't remember what it was called, and we got this gig there, and it was a sort of rundown Victorian hotel with a little ballroom, which was not much bigger than the room that we're in now, and in the corner there was a little stage, so you sat up there, and of course, because we were a Glasgow band and we were making the trip to Grangemouth, we were a big deal, and we had to hire a van and all that kind of stuff and get down there with all of our gear. But I was concerned that we were getting a split on the door, and I was concerned about that we weren't going to make any money because we had to pay for the van, etc. Because there wasn't a lot of people there. There were the Grangemouth punks who were, I guess, were about a dozen kids.
Did they support you? They were not favourably on you.
Well, they came because that was the only gig that was there. And among them was our support band who we'd asked, who we'd booked. And one of them, I remember they were so lovely and so sweet, and they played for us. And then when we came on, as they came on, when we stepped into the corner, when we exchanged places in the corner, And they stayed and they danced and all that and were very supportive. And then at the end of the night, the promoter gave me the money. Promoter, I don't know, the hotel owner guy gave me the money. And there wasn't enough money to pay for the van. There wasn't enough money to, there certainly wasn't enough money to play the support band. So I thought, well, we'll just have to do a runner here. I can't tell them the truth because I can't I can't destroy their belief in that we're the big Glasgow band. So I said, well, I'll keep them talking and you guys back up the stuff and then we'll make it. So I had to keep the support band talking and while I kept them and avoiding the topic of money. And then when I realised that the van was packed up, I said, I've just got to go to the loo. And then I jumped in the van and off we went.
That's terrible.
Yeah, and it was the Cocktail Twins, of course,
really?
Who were fantastic and became very celebrated. And the gods of rock and roll took them to their hearts.
Oh,
and,
you know, wow.
So they, have you seen them since? Have they reminisced about you?
No,
them?
But I'd like to apologise to them publicly. Always bother me, irrespective of the fact of them becoming famous. It always bothered me that I had to do that. And I always hated being part of that part of the business.
Yeah.
But there was no money.
I think you should make amends.
We've all done things we regret.
I think you need to step nine.
Yeah. So, and also, you're only kids as well. Yeah. You're only really, what age? 22, 23.
That's really, really fucked up, Peter.
So what happened next? We've only got to you with what year are we now? What year is the disgraceful treatment of the Cocteau Twins? The stabbing in the back. Lost their Cocteau.
I know. It was so awful of me to do that. I don't know how much I owe them.
You could probably afford to give it to
$12.50 or something like that. What happened then? Well, we just kept doing gigs. I left art school. Graduated from art school. But really wanted to, you know, keep doing the music thing. And I got odds and ends of jobs at the BBC during... they used to have short-term contracts where you could do... So I used to work for the graphics department and do illustrations for them. But I would use all the equipment for making album sleeves and record covers and posters and stuff like that.
For your band?
Yeah.
Okay, they're still going. Okay.
Yeah. But while I was in the band, we were doing... we fell into Altered Images, who were around at the time, who were very sweet to us, and Claire Grosvenor, who were all lovely to us, and all the bands were lovely to us. You know, they always take us.
Comedians are fucking horrible.
Yeah, no, all the bands were really sweet, and everybody who was successful would, you know, give you a slot or whatever. Really? And Altered Images were really sweet, and we did a little tour supporting them, and then we supported them in Glasgow or something. And Bill Forsyth, who was a film director, who directed Gregory's Girl, was at this gig, I think. I say I think because a lot of my memories are occluded with alcohol, which was flowing very freely at the time. Bill struck up a conversation with me about this and that after the gig. And then... some months passed, and then I was I rented a room in a flat in Glasgow, and I came home one night again, the worse for wear, with alcohol, and Bill was there, and I think I regaled him with tales of my life.
He was there by accident. Yeah.
No, he wasn't there by accident. He was there because my landlady was also a costume designer, and she'd been the costume designer on his latest film thing. So that's, he was there seeing her.
So Bill Forsyth is there. Yeah. Oh, coincidentally also lived in a sort of house that was behind Muriel Gray's house for many years.
Yes, Muriel's a constant...
constant theme in this, in our lives. Presence,
yes.
Yeah.
Mm. Or indeed, you know, Glasgow's quite a smart... It's funny, I was reading a book the other day about Creation Records. And Alan McGee,
right,
who I can't see as this, you know, manager of Oasis and all that stuff like that. And I'm reading this book, and he's in a band that supported us in Glasgow, or maybe we supported them. I can't remember. But you go, well, this is a whole milieu that there was a lot of people doing stuff, and it was a very It's a very creative time.
But that's one of the extraordinary things, isn't it, in a way, about, I suppose, the arts, particularly in Britain, is that something that's just, like in Liverpool or Glasgow, then suddenly kind of explodes and people are listening to the end product in Caracas or, you know, fucking Kyoto or wherever it is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you, I mean, how did, I mean, if you went to art school, what did your parents think about you going to art school? I mean, was that a surprise?
No, I think they were. Well, my mum went to my interview for Foundation. I didn't go because I was away hitchhiking across Europe or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they were happy that I went to art school. They always. I mean, my mother always had this idea that I was, you know, unique. I mean, I was a very spoiled child in a way, very indulged. I was both indulged and kind of relentlessly criticised. So, I mean, I think I was always encouraged with the idea that I had a unique vision, you know, which needed to be communicated, which turned out to be true.
So where did you go then? Did you do a foundation in Liverpool?
Well, I was sort of expelled from school. Or they told me I couldn't come back. Which I don't know, that's quite expulsion, but told me not to come back. So I went and did 2 years foundation at Southport, you know, a little town in Lancashire.
Right.
Which was the happiest time of my life in many ways.
Right.
And then I was interviewed for... Well, that's interesting talking to you about that experience of coming down and auditioning for drama schools, because I had that... It's a weird kind of day in your life or whatever when you come down to London. I had it where I came down and auditioned for Chelsea. Yeah. I think I actually had friends in London. I was going to stay overnight, but in the end, I remember going back to some bloke lured me back to his flat after the audition, and he had a 16mm film projector somewhere in Notting Hill Gate. I remember he had a 16mm. He was going to show me some films. I don't know what. And then I panicked and sort of ran off.
Right.
And sort of ran to Euston. I remember I got like my folder, you know them. Did you have like
folio?
Folio, is that a folio? Is that, but it's like it's
folio, a big red one.
Yeah. Big red one, yeah.
Dark red.
Yeah, dark
burgundy.
Red. Burgundy, yeah, with black corners.
Yeah.
And I managed to put wheels on mine.
Wow.
So little wheels. I remember running for the last train to Liverpool through Euston, taking some bloke's ankles out with me. With me artwork. On his little wheels, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
And then going back, you know, going back. It's the day you do your interview for art school or the day you audition for drama school in London. I think is particularly for a working class kid is one of the strangest days of your life, really.
And also, London is it's like in a Dickens novel.
Yeah.
You know, you're sort of deposited. I mean, Euston is. I can't go through Euston. And I go through Euston a lot because obviously I still travel up and down to Glasgow. But the place is so evocative.
Yeah.
And that great kind of glassy kind of floor.
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of brilliant. Yeah.
And of course, there had been a terrible... one's parents were always very frightened about you going to London, you know, because they only knew horror stories about what happened to kids there, some of which were true. But you sort of had to do, but it was a different time.
Yeah. I mean, I did because I was much more familiar with London. And, although I was no less intimidated, I think, because I think thought I knew it. And then when I moved down here, I suddenly realised that I didn't. I was just still felt horribly alone and stuff.
Yeah.
That's for another day. But so.
Bill Forsyth.
You're in this band. Yeah. Bill Forsyth is round at your gaff. Trying to get off with the costume designer.
No, that's not what was happening.
No, that's not what was happening. We won't put that in then. Bill Forsyth is round at your flat, costume designer. You amuse him immensely with your drunken shenanigans.
Yeah. And some weeks later, he phones me up and says, would you like to be in a film?
You had no idea that...
I didn't really know what to...
One thing would lead to another.
No.
And you're living in London at this point?
No.
No, you're
still
Glasgow.
Up there. Okay.
Yeah. And the film turned out to be a local hero.
I know.
But it wasn't
Shit, was that your first job?
But it wasn't as straightforward as that, because...
Love that film.
Bill gave me this script to read, which was... I hadn't really seen the script. I didn't really know how this worked. And I kept asking, when is it? When's it happening? Blah, blah. And then it all went very quiet. And then I thought, well, that's not happening. And then I had to go and do a screen test. So I had to come down to London. I had to come on a, I was put on a plane.
A plane.
Go on a shuttle, which was most exciting. People smoking. If you smoked, you smoked at the back of the plane. I smoked then. I came down to Bray Studios, which was so exciting because that was where I knew they'd filmed all the old Hammer horror movies there. So that was hugely exciting for me. And I had to do the screen test for this part. And then I didn't know whether it was going to happen or not. And then eventually the foreman said, yeah, it was happening. So, and then I was sort of whisked off to this this magical kingdom that was the set of Local Hero.
Which was where?
It was in two places. It was if you've seen the film, it's about a kind of it's about an American who comes to investigate the possibility of a Grangemouth style
oil refinery. Like a pipeline, or
In this little beautiful piece of coastline
in Scotland,
yeah. But they couldn't find a suitably quaint village and a suitably beautiful beach next to each other, which is how it was in the script.
Yeah.
So they shot the village. It's Pennon, which is on the east coast of Scotland. The beach is in Malig, which is on the west coast of Scotland. Yeah. So we shot on the west coast of Scotland. So it was a kind of incredible experience.
What year was this?
1981, I think, 82. But I'm trying to figure out whether
I studied that film.
Did you?
In film studies.
Oh, wow.
There was like one of the terms was we wrote an essay on. This is so surreal. Oh.
Sorry, so it was very. It was
yeah,
very,
and what about me? What did you study?
Fuck no.
I remember just seeing it, and also, I mean, it's a great film anyway, but I remember being struck by, there's a quality about your performance, which is also, I guess, which probably now, I would guess, was derived from the fact that you hadn't been trained, or you hadn't
not a clue.
Yeah, but that works to your advantage in that film. It's a remarkable performance. You seem so kind of natural, and, you know. Well, I remember didn't know you then. I guess I would have just about been in the business, but still not really. You know, I'd only done maybe just about started in telly, but you know, it just seemed. It seemed at the time a fantastic film, and you seemed fantastic in it. Really.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I didn't have a clue. Again, I didn't have a clue. You know, and really, I was. If you see the film, you can see, if you look carefully, you'll see I've got a pierced ear because I really had an earring and all that. I was more used to having like electric red hair and stuff like that, and dressed in black and stuff like that. So this playing this kind of geeky kind of character wasn't really I didn't know how to do this. I was just lucky Bill was such a good director and just told me not to act. Just kept saying, don't act. But I mean, it was a very bizarre experience in that it came out of left field, and suddenly I was lifted out of, you know, I went from eating curries and playing in a band and drinking too much.
You wouldn't be for money, you would be signing on or whatever.
I'd just be signing on.
Which was a thing that used to happen then where the government gave you money if you were unemployed.
Yeah. But I remember the very first day it was snowing. And we were shooting on the beach, and we were shooting with Burt Lancaster. So this is a really bizarre kind of thing.
Should point out, though, knowing you now, that you're also, which I assume you had then, you have an encyclopedic knowledge of film culture, music.
I was very interested in all this kind of stuff, so that I knew. So I knew who Burt Lancaster,
I don't know, I never knew anything about, I was not a
cinephile
or anything. I never knew anything. I mean, deliberately, in a way, never knew anything about anything. Whereas you knew everything about everything.
Well, I didn't know everything, but I was interested. I found out stuff because I was interested in things, in film and all that kind of stuff. Mm. And Burt Lancaster was a big star. He was a huge Hollywood star. But of the golden age. So to find yourself standing on a beach with him
in the snow.
In the snow, acting, being terrified to act was wonderful. But he was wonderful. You know, he was great. He said, "Kid, gotta tell you, kid." He said, "You have." He said, "Your instinct is fabulous. Can't understand a fucking word you say, but your instinct is fabulous."
Great.
So he was great. But the whole thing was, you know, the whole thing was a great experience. I can only say that it was like the film itself. And I was very lucky that I met Dennis Lawson, who sort of took me under his wing and has remained a friend to this day, and who understood that I knew nothing and understood that I was hopeless and understood that I had to be carefully, you know, taught little bits and pieces.
Well, it is. I mean, to be dumped, I mean, it's so... Yeah. I mean, you learn quick if you're talented, but I mean, it is... Working, I mean, it's particularly then, I suppose even now, it's all like, just like, I mean, filmmaking was, it's such a weird, you know, such a weird experience. And people like tearing out bits of cardboard and hanging them in front of your face and stuff for the light, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's all that kind of thing.
Yeah. But also it was not the world that I came from. Although I was interested in it, it wasn't, I was used to bands and, and art school and painting and you know, I wasn't used to people who'd been at the RSC and people who had who knew how to do Shakespeare and people who had been in film. I mean, David Putnam, who produced, had just produced, I mean, Chariots of Fire had just won, you know, however many Oscars it won and stuff like that. And they all just seemed, they were sort of terrifyingly different and successful and other.
Yeah.
Very kind and very, very open. But the thing that strikes me is that if I'd been smart, or if it happened 5 years later, I would have just gone to LA or something. But you don't know anything. All I did was I went back to Glasgow and bought all my pals drinks and curries. That was my response to it. Instead of going, oh, wait a minute, you know, fate has just given you this.
Yeah.
It has told you that you've been rejected by drama school and you just got a part in a big movie.
Yeah.
Go with this.
Yeah.
You know, it took me about a year to realize that I should go with it, you know.
Yeah. So what happened?
I just said, well, I got to go and learn how to do this.
Did you wait until the movie came out to go and for you?
I can't remember, actually. I think, yeah, the movie was coming out. I mean, but these were different times then, you know, and I can remember I couldn't get an agent. Mm.
Even though you'd been in a Hollywood movie, you couldn't get an agent.
Yeah. I was told by one celebrated agent, I'll always remember this, he said, "The phone's not exactly ringing off the hook for young Scottish boys," he said. And I thought, all right, okay, well, what do I do? That's that. Therefore, there's no market for me. So I thought, well, if you don't know... I don't know anything about acting, so I better learn about it. So I tried to get jobs in it. So I'd write to people in the theatre, try and get... It's so crazy now. Now you go and get a proper agent and just go and wipe people's noses in it, you know, and just get on. And but you too, you don't... I didn't know anything. I didn't know anything about this world.
When did you meet Elaine?
Well, not until I was 27, was about 5 years later, which because was after, because after that, what happened then was I came to London and I mean, the band broke up because we couldn't really, we weren't getting anywhere and I was kind of, I thought, well, I really want to pursue this. And also in the band, I was the one that had to do all the going around record companies and getting all the rejections and getting and taking, making all the, you know, we didn't have a manager. I had to do all of that. And I thought, this is just too much. So I came to London and I'd written to lots of people to try and get jobs in the theatre and tried to get, eventually got an agent and eventually got a job at the Young Vic and did about three plays there. And
So what year would that be?
1982, 1983.
So you came to London. You knew people by then in London, or it was
not really. Dennis,
right?
Dennis was very sweet, so he looked after me. But no, I didn't really know him.
That was all right.
Hmm. Was it all right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. Well, it was great. It was wonderful. It was like kind of I was, the first job I got was, it was, you know, it was connected to music. It was a John, Paul, George, Ringo and Bert, and connected to Liverpool.
Oh, right, yeah.
Which was a Willie Russell play, which was great. I was miscast, really, as John Lennon, as Bert as George Harrison, which I played later on. But they couldn't, for some reason, they couldn't find a John, someone who would do it. So I played John Lennon in this, in Young Vic's revival of John Paul, George, Ringo and Bert. But also you had to be able to play guitar and stuff like that. So that's one of the reasons I was there. And it was great fun, because you got to be in a bit. And also I met Stephen Lewis, who was wonderful, who older listeners may remember as Blakey from On the Buses. Yeah.
Later in my show.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. But who was a delightful man. And he was thrilling because he was off the telly.
Yeah.
And also he was, it struck me that he was so much more than what they had told us he was. So much more than what the sitcom had
said. Yeah, well, because he was a graduate of the Theatre Royal Stratford East.
That's right, and also he'd written a lot of screenplays and stuff like that. But at that time, if you had, I guess it was a thing I recognised, he had an accent.
Yeah.
He had a Cockney accent. So at that time, you weren't going to go to the National Theatre. You weren't going to get a job there. The only jobs that were open to you were sitcoms, where you could play comedy Cockneys and stuff like that.
I hate you, butler.
Yeah, but I mean, and he was great at that. Yeah. But he was also, he was a real student of comedy and drama, and a really clever and interesting man. It's not going on for ages and ages and ages.
It's how long have we been going?
We've just hit an hour.
It's fine though. I mean, there's no. I was thinking we might split this into two maybe at some point, since we haven't even got to it.
I think it might only be interesting to me.
I think fucking the fans or your.
But yeah, we've only just started on your acting career.
Yeah,
we haven't.
Yeah.
Well, we should perhaps hurry up. Then.
Whatever. My concern.
Wow, well, whew, what a... those two guys, they're great. Yeah. That was part one of Very Christmas Capaldi. Part two will be coming over the holidays. Do you want to say bye-bye, Talal?
Bye-bye, Talal. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Bye-bye.
A million listenings.
Bye-bye to all you million people out there listening.
Well, it's not a million people.
It is.
A million listens probably spread over
sequentially.
About 40, 50,000 people.
Yeah.
But thanks to them. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.